Welcome to the Public Morality. The San Francisco Chronicle recently published a piece on Senator Dianne Feinstein in which her colleagues expressed concern that she is now, quote, mentally unfit to serve, unquote, and that her staff is doing much of the work. Various individuals, including four U.S. senators and three former staffers, told the Chronicle that her memory is rapidly deteriorating and she can no longer fulfill her job duties as a result of her alleged cognitive decline. She is currently serving her term through the end of 2024. This unfortunate disclosure about Senator Feinstein has once again raised calls to enact term limits for members of Congress. But are term limits an overly simplistic solution to a more complex problem? Or, as H.L. Mencken stated, for every complex problem, there is an answer that's clear, simple, and wrong. Joining me to discuss term limits is Professor Casey Burgert. Professor Burgert is Legislative Affairs Program Director and Assistant Professor at George Washington University. Professor Casey Burgert, welcome to the Public Morality.
Thank you for having me.
What is the problem, in your view, that term limits seeks to address?
That everyone hates politics. And so if you hate that, then the people that are in office right now, it only makes sense, at least logically, that if we hate everything about what they're doing or more often what they're not doing, then let's get new people in there. And there's an assumption made that people hold office as long as they want to, that once you're in, it's kind of your spot to lose. And so the only way to fix that is to provide a measure that escorts them out of the buildings so that they can't hold power forever.
Okay, so if I say to you, Professor Burgert, Congress is broken. It's ineffectual. Term limits is the only way to drain the swamp. How do you respond to that?
That I'll grant you the first part, that Congress is broken. It's not living up to the role that we expect it to play in our system of government. There's a lot of reasons for that. And to reduce any of those problems to one single solution is unhelpful. We should be honest about what's wrong with our politics in each and be honest about why we got this way. Some of it's been, most of it's been purposeful. Because of politicians, because of leaders, and a lot of it because of voters or non-voters, we should have an honest conversation about what's wrong with politics. And so to portray term limits as a silver bullet is not at all helpful. And in fact, will make a lot of things that about our politics that we already hate even worse.
So what's your response to those that offer that term limits would create a citizen legislature from all walks of life who would be better equipped to address the problems currently facing the country?
Yeah, it makes sense. And I'll grant you that. But what I always point out is that one, we've never really been a citizen legislature. I mean, even going back to the founding when it was seen as like a civic duty rather than a career in and of itself. These were the richest, the whitest, the most elite people our country had. And so to pretend that there was this golden age of a citizen-led legislature of just fully civic-minded people is neither true nor helpful. And so term limits would just exacerbate a lot of the problems that we already have within our politics. It will transfer power away from the most representative body, the Congress, to the executive branch, and it will empower staffers that do have the experience level that we just kicked out the door because they were term limited in their roles. So it will do nothing to solve a lot of the problems that we think it will.
Now many cite, I would add with some justification, the members of Congress spend more time raising money than they do the people's business. Mm-hmm. And they offer term limits that takes away that incentive. Your thoughts, sir?
It would only take away that incentive during the very last term of their term limit. So let's say that there's a 6-year term limit on House members, 3 terms of 2 years. The first 5 years, that doesn't do anything to change their incentive structure. And what that does ignore is that these people, it will just assume that these people will go back to their previous lives. That's not true. We've studied the type of person that runs for politics. These are typically ambitious folks that want a public service bent. And so they studies have shown that they look for their next role as they're working on their current role. So if you term limit them, you're just going to exacerbate that process of them not going back to their lawyerships or their doctorships or public teachers or accountants, whatever they were before Congress. But they're actually going to try to stay in the game, knowing that they just spent a lot of time and money gaining these skills, and now it's time to cash in. So that will not only exacerbate the lobbyist problem that we have, because a lot of former members turn to lobbying, it will actually reduce the capacity of the chamber. It will take away the experience that we need within the chamber to write good representative policy.
Well, you just mentioned a key word that seems to be antithetical to this conversation, in that from my vantage point, the conversation about term limits seems to assume that experience with an elected official is a pejorative when every other walk of life, it is an asset.
100%. There's not one job that you would mention, especially something as complex as lawmaking, that there's not one job where experience is demonized. Politics is kind of the exception. I want my pilots to have experience. I want my doctors to have experience. I want my lawyers to have experience. Anyone in the walk of life, you learn the job as you do the job. We shouldn't think about politics any differently. And we need to have an honest conversation amongst ourselves that representation and policy making are incredibly uncertain topics, right? They're impossible. There's no guidebook of like, here's the 1, 2, 3 to good policy. Experience matters, and to recognize pitfalls, to be able to anticipate the unintended consequences, and there's always unintended consequences in policymaking. Seeing that experience level as a virtue rather than a vice is a good first step.
Well, you mentioned unintended consequences, and term limits seems to have wide bipartisan support among the American people. I think I saw one poll I saw as high as 81%. Mm-hmm. Short of sounding elitist, what in your view are the unintended consequences you just referenced that may not be factored in support for term limits?
So policymaking is incredibly difficult. I mean, there's not many bills that are in isolation on an issue area. So if you touch one thing, let's say healthcare, write a bill about healthcare, you're going to touch almost everything else within that's related or tangentially related to healthcare. The economy, taxes, commerce, intrastate federalism rights, there's the list is endless. And so to be able to see the bigger scope, to see the holistic view of government, representation, policymaking, actually just takes experience. So if you term limit them to be able to gain that experience and capitalize on that, those hard-earned lessons, you're going to hamstring yourself to write good policy. Adding to that, you're going to transfer power away from Congress, the most directly elected branch of government, to people that are not term limited, whether that's officials in the executive branch, not just the president and his cabinet secretaries, but actually the bureaucrats that are not term limited that stay there, developing that expertise. And then more drain the swamp messaging, you're going to transfer power to lobbyists. Lobbyists are not term limited. Their whole game is not only providing access to their clients, but actually expertise on certain issue areas. So if you remove the incentive to develop expertise to politicians who know they're going to be looking for work in 2, 4, 6 years, you remove that incentive structure to develop those modicums of expertise, and then you rely on people that do know it. And so if you can't have that internal capacity with your own selves within Congress, you're going to start looking elsewhere. And for a government that is built on the fact that we elect representatives to represent our issue areas, the more that you force people to look outside the chamber for answers, and answers in DC always come with a partisan agenda, the more you do that, the less power you're actually giving to your voters to have representation within the chambers.
Well, to that extent, is some of this related to the fact that we see Congress people on television often? We do not see, and we shouldn't see, congressional staffs on television, nor do we see special interests on television. So is some of this driven by what we actually see as opposed to what some of the mechanics of governing that you just outlined?
Yeah, and no doubt. But then we should talk about how those incentive structures lie. I don't blame people for using the avenues of the media today to influence their own brand. I want my representative to do it if he or she is using it in a way to garner influence to then cash in chits to make policies that reflect our districts and our state in a beneficial way. But the reality of having a Congress that is ineffective and incredibly polarized, with a social media and a media environment that rewards extremism, the term limit argument would only make that worse, in that the faster you speed up the cycle of replacement of politicians, so if people are term limited to 3 terms, you're going to have turnover more often, which people see as a good thing, but it will actually exacerbate a lot of the polarization that we see now. Because there are so few competitive districts and states as a result of polarization, by speeding up that election cycle, you're effectively speeding up how quickly polarization happens. People win in their primary elections. The only way you win in a primary election is to go more extreme, more base than the person that is more moderate. And doing that will just send more and more people that are at the tails of extremes in their parties to represent those interests in DC. So you can see how this is as simple as it sounds of just kicking out career politicians. It actually will have a huge amount of consequences, even just how our politics works within Congress.
And to that end, term limits doesn't mitigate what I'm hearing you say, some of the institutional structures that incentivize, you know, parties to work, you know, majority party work against the minority party, that incentivizes the current Senate structure where it's really minority rule unless you have more than 60 votes on your side. So the term limits does nothing to change those incentives. Would that be correct?
It will make them worse. So you're right. In the Senate, at least, you need 60 votes to get most controversial things done, or at least something that doesn't have broad bipartisan support. And those issues are few and far between. Because you will incentivize people to maintain their popularity with the voters that keep them or send them to office. And that happens within primary elections. And those we know who turns out in primary elections are the most dedicated. Those that are most dedicated are often the most extreme of their parties, the least likely to see compromising positions. And so as a result, you're going to get politicians who see compromise as the quickest way to lose their seat rather than a way to develop a resume of legislative accomplishments to take back to their voters and say, look how much I did for us. You can see how that incentive structure becomes one of opposition, because my voters sent me here as member of the minority party to stop the other side. It's not enough to get things done. I get punished for being seen as someone that helped them get their job done. It's just diametrically opposed incentives right now.
I'm talking with Professor Casey Burgert of George Washington University. Professor Burgert, it's really interesting because we look at, say, presidential polling, and let's say President Biden has a 38% approval rating. I'm just making this up. And let's say that is juxtaposed with Congress having a 20% approval rating. But what those types of numbers don't show is that particular congressman in his or her district has maybe a 50-55% approval. So these polls about the low polling of Congress is also insulated by the individual's district or their state. So the gripe against Congress really isn't revealing just looking at poll numbers.
100%. You nailed one of the paradoxes of Congress, is that Congress as an institution is incredibly unpopular, and it's never been really popular, but now we're at the dearth of popularity now. But our individual members of Congress remain popular. There's a high reelection rates that people, if maintain their positions and maintain their standing within their communities, it's their job to lose, which is why term limit advocates, they point to those high re-election rates as a need to shake up the system. And I kind of get that. But individually, doesn't match the unpopularity of the institution as a whole. It's one of the paradoxes of politics and of Congress. And it just goes to show you that in Congress, as it was designed to be, it is not a national body, that a national sample of poll respondents isn't a good measure of what people think about their individual members of Congress. And so we should be focused on our district representatives and our state representatives within the Senate. And then kind of the whole national mood is it should be left to the presidency, who's kind of our only national representative, the only one with a national electorate.
How do you respond to those that offer that it was never the intention of the framers of the Constitution to have career politicians? How do you respond to that argument?
Almost all of them were career politicians in some way, or at least a great many of them. So yeah, it probably wasn't their intentions, but they also recognize that they couldn't see the future. I mean, they wrote a constitution when there weren't street lamps, to say nothing of the internet. And so we should think about Congress in the modern day and age of, like, why wouldn't we want our best and our brightest to get there? And if we rest on the assumption that voters do have a choice, and we do each and every 2 years for the House side and 6 years for the Senate side, to choose our politicians, that we shouldn't have to have these draconian measures that take away that power because we're not good enough about judging who we should have in there in the first place. To be forthright about what we expect of our members of Congress, what's realistic to get things done, how our members of Congress are behaving within their jobs and as leaders in a political environment, but more importantly, of just like Congress, a member should service, civic duty, civic service within Congress is not desirable. So we should try to get the best and brightest that we can. And then if they're doing a good job, send them back. And if they're not, let's try something new. And that's what elections are for. We shouldn't need this cutoff of service at some arbitrary deadline saying, hey, you've had your time, now let's go get someone new.
And if we follow that logic, it would seem to me that while attacking term limits, there would be also an effort to address the influence of political parties, because clearly I'm thinking about James Madison, Federalist 10, Federalist 51, and elsewhere. He seemed more concerned with curbing the negative impact of factions than he did about career politicians. Your thoughts?
100%. And I teach those Federalist Papers in one of my first classes of every single semester. And the point of those factions is, like, air is to fire what factions is to liberty, is what he said. And so he's talking about how we know that people are going to try to find friends. And in politics, especially in a democracy where the most votes wins, you need friends to do anything. And so factions are dangerous. Yes, they are. They can be, especially if their goals are not to provide public services or good public policy, but we're not going to get rid of them. And in a democracy where the most votes wins, it's only logical, and we should want our members of Congress or any politicians to go find friends to get the most votes. That's how it's supposed to work. The alternative is even worse. So we should be able to provide an opportunity where factions can be developed, and then most importantly, to design a system, which the founders did incredibly good at, to create a space where those factions can come and have legitimate disagreements, where you put your best policy forward, you debate it, you amend it, you take perspectives inside and outside of the bubble, and then whomever's votes gets the most, those win. But right now what we have is factions for faction's sake, or party loyalty to then explain where you stand on an issue. It should be flipped. I should be able to go find factions based on where I stand. And a lot of times our party ideologies will align, but if they don't, we should have an opportunity to or an incentive structure to go find friends across the aisle to try to get things done. And the reality is our current political environment does not incentivize that enough. And in fact, it punishes that type of work, that cross-party lines, cross-party coalitions legislating that the Congress was built upon.
Well, underneath that, what I'm hearing you say is, sticking on the theme of factions for just a moment, have we made, in your view, the factions, parties, special interests, sort of a cabal, all of the above, more important than those fundamental democratic republican norms that the country was committed to? So are the parties more important than the democratic norms?
I guess I'm not comfortable saying they're more important, but if I research is showing over and over that whatever party you are aligned, you're going to see your world through that party lens, that it takes a lot to be able to buck your party's stance on that issue. And in fact, the party that you adhere to is most is going to tell you what you stand for. When you think like, no, I depending on how I stand on an issue, that will tell me what party most agrees with me. Right now, that's kind of flipped in that partisanship is motivating us rather than us being motivated to go find parties that agree with us. So this is kind of the point, though, is that notice we're not talking about term limits, which is proposed as a silver bullet to all of these problems. But we have a lot of problems, each with their own causes and consequences and individual solutions. So if you're mad at lobbyists, let's write laws about lobbying. If you're mad at money in politics, let's write laws or probably now an amendment attacking money in politics. To pretend that the brush, the all of the problems with our politics, and there are a great many, will all be solved if we can just limit the number of years politicians can serve is just going to make a lot of things worse and frustrate people in the meantime.
You know, you raised that. I was just thinking as I was teaching my class last night, we were talking about this very issue, in fact. And one of the points that I made, someone asked me for an example, and one of the points that I made to them was, in 2016, when then Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said that 8 months was not enough time to have a Supreme Court hearing because President Obama was about to be termed out. Mm-hmm. But 8 weeks was more than enough time right before the 2020 election. And my point to them was, no one on McConnell's side of the aisle was opposed to that. Well, very few were opposed to that. But everyone on McConnell's side of the aisle would be opposed if the situation were reversed. So ultimately, I'm wondering, that kind of allegiance that you're talking about, does it sort of methodically erode our democratic norms in your view?
100%. We have a huge problem with, I mean, so much of how Congress and politics in general is supposed to operate isn't written down. It's this iterative process that is developed over time. Congress is a path-dependent institution, meaning whatever came before is probably the best guess about how things are supposed to work in the future. But the thing about norms, these traditions, these customs, and the Senate is a body built on those things, where very few rules are actually in place. I mean, when they break down, when you break them, they're really, really hard to get back. It's like trust in a relationship. It's assumed to work. And then the minute it stops working, it's really hard to envision a time when we can go back and just reset, press the reset button. It doesn't work like that, especially in a body, in a industry where power is constantly up for grabs in every 2, 4, 6 years. So these are self-reinforcing problems that have real impact on not only how the place works, if it does at all, but even how our members and ourselves back to each other, treat each other, think of each other, where you can disagree without being disagreeable. That's kind of gone, right? Where it's everything's inflamed and everything's so toxic right now that we see the other side as dangerous, less than enemies, unpatriotic. We even see our leaders using this type of language, which is a huge sign of democratic backsliding and what really smart people that study failing democracies around the world are kind of warning us about where the US is headed, that we shouldn't pretend that all of this will always work or that we'll always snap back just because we're America. Democracy is one of those things where if you don't work for it, it'll disappear.
You touched on this earlier, but I'd like to have you spend more time, if you would, talk about the importance of institutional memory in Congress. And if term limits were enacted, where would that institutional memory go if you have someone termed out after 6 years or 12 years?
Yeah, I'll start at the last part. Where will it institutional memory go? It'll leave and it will go to, well, one, and what people think about term limits is probably solving is it will go to special interest groups. Like I said, that when you term limit people out, they're not just going to forfeit the experience that they just spent a lot of years, money and heartache earning. Relationships, special expertise on a certain issue area, the policymaking process, the archaic language of congressional procedures, all of that stuff will go to somewhere else that will pay them for that experience. And we shouldn't fault people or pretend that incentive doesn't exist. And so it will go to special interest groups. It might go to the executive branch or worse, it will leave politics entirely where it just kind of is people that are so frustrated with politics will just kind of sit out. And that's a bad return on the investment that we paid for with our public servants. So I for one, think it's a worthwhile investment to make people that have the best interests of the institution and their constituents at heart to keep them in the chamber. Because like I said, we're paying their salary now. They're getting good at it. They're gaining that experience that we should think as valuable. Because if I weren't in policymaking now, I would have no idea how it works. Just the same way I know that if I go get a heart surgery, I'm not going to be the one that says, you know what, give me the fresh eyes out there. I want someone who has a different perspective on heart valves. I think that's a bad return on my investment of health. And we should think about civic service and policymaking in much the same way.
And that institutional memory goes hand in hand with the previous question I had for you just about the notion of experience. You can't have institutional memory void of experience. So it's almost counterintuitive. Go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah, no, it's counterintuitive. And it might even be more so with policymaking and the legislative process. Because there's no school for this, right? Like I keep mentioning doctors as someone we want and value experience for this. But during medical school, they have literal requirements that they're doing these things under the guise of a professional, making sure that they're doing it right. They have hands-on training. There's no real hands-on training for politics. There's state legislatures and city councils and things like that where you are within the industry, but it ain't the same thing. And so the real on-the-training job is the minute you get the job in and of itself. And if you term limit that, not only are you eventually going to forfeit that experience, but you're actually decreasing the incentive to learn the place from the inside out. If I know that my career has to change in 6 years, why would I want to spend five of them becoming the best at it? It just doesn't make sense from a human interest perspective.
You know, when you were saying that, I was thinking about Robert Carroll's last book on Lyndon Johnson, and he talked about how Johnson used this arcane House rule to get to overcome the filibuster that Southern Democrats were using. The Senate rule, to get Southern Democrats to override their filibuster of the 64 Civil Rights Act. So that's a good example, to your point, of where Johnson's experience, you know, moved the country forward.
100%. And if you're just thinking about it from a self-interested voter, if my member of Congress doesn't have the experience, he or she's going to lose to someone, oftentimes to someone that does. And so we should... For our own voters and for a Congress as an institution, we should want the people that recognize that experience, that want to invest in that type of expertise, because it will benefit us all. Always knowing that they have to face re-election at some point. Voters have the ultimate power. And though those elections are skewed oftentimes, they're not skewed because of the amount of time that members serve in office. They're skewed for a lot of different reasons that term limits would not address and, in fact, would probably make worse.
You know, we talked earlier about institutional memory, but one of the sort of stagnant concepts is power. Power is there. So if you limit the term of lawmakers, that power dynamic, because that's one of the arguments I've heard for term limits, is that you limit the power of lawmakers. But that assumes that once that power dynamic is gone, it is gone forever. But that power dynamic, just like institutional memory, will go elsewhere.
Exactly. It's not a zero-sum change, but power is not just going to disappear and everyone's equal. You'll even see the dynamic that we have now, where a lot of power is centralized in party leaders that have been there a long time, the Nancy Pelosi's and the Mitch McConnell's and things like that, the Lyndon Johnson's before them. But that will just be sped up, right? Where your freshman term lawmakers are going to rely on people that have been there, the two-term serving, the three-term serving, especially. There's going to be a Speaker of the House. That Speaker is going to have outsized influence because of their constitutional and internal prerogatives. And so, yeah, the power won't shift and just be dispersed equally. You'll just speed up that process just because when you don't know something, you do what every person does. You Google it, and in Congress, when that doesn't work, you go find someone who you trust that does. And so that deference to someone else who wasn't elected by your constituents is going to have that outsized influence. And that's even if it's inside the chamber. If it's not, and more likely when you have term limits for everybody, you're going to look outside the chambers for that influence, the executive branch, the lobbyists, and that will just make a lot of the problems that we think term limits will solve even worse.
You know, Justice Louis Brandeis was famous for saying that that the states were the laboratories for democracy. So if we follow that thinking, mm-hmm. and we look at some of the states that have enacted term limits, what's been their record from your perspective?
What's the what? I'm sorry?
Their record and the states that have enacted term limits. What's been their record?
So a few political scientists have looked at this question because we don't have the answer to what would happen in Congress at the federal level if term limits existed, because they never have. And so we look at the closest thing to them and how has that changed the dynamic within state legislatures. And what they've noticed is that a lot of the assumed benefits of term limits haven't actually been realized. It doesn't change the type of person that ends up running for office, though it does get a little more representative in some instances, but there are reasons why that's true that are outside term limits. It finds that people after their term limited go seek other elected office and that they start looking for those jobs a little bit sooner. It transfers power from the legislature to the executive in each of those states by lessening the dependence on voters to keep them in office. Members of state legislatures take actions that are not necessarily with their constituents' best interests in mind. And so budgets get bigger. They spend less time actually meeting with constituents and providing constituent services, things like that. So there's actually things get worse a little bit and things and aspects that we don't assume to be at all related to term limits pop up while not actually realizing many of the benefits that we assume to take place.
In those studies, do states become more polarized? I'm originally from California, and we enacted some very draconian term limits, really to get rid of one elected official, in my view, which was Willie Brown. He was the powerful Speaker of the Assembly, but California has become uber partisan mm-hmm. in that. A cup of water with a D on its name
will get
elected, before any viable Republican. So in your experience, are states more polarized that have enacted term limits in the studies? Have they shown that?
I don't think they have shown that, but I think we're facing a chicken and the egg problem here. Do term limits exacerbate polarization in the states? That's not independent of the actual trends that were leading us to more polarization in the first place. So to disentangle those two things are incredibly difficult. And I haven't seen a study that's been able to do that effectively.
One of the reasons we wanted to have you on was right on the heels of an article that was run by the San Francisco Chronicle that talked about Senator Dianne Feinstein's declining mental health, and she can't remember people. And even members of the Senate and House, she can't remember. And we've also had some other senators that stayed a long time. Strom Thurmond of South Carolina, Robert Byrd of West Virginia in the House, John Dingell, who I think is still in Congress, the longest serving member. And this has revived, I guess, the term limit argument. If there were term limits, we could avoid having members serving too long. How do you respond to that?
Yeah, so to me, there are different problems. To have someone staying past their internal capacities can be solved in ways that don't limit everyone else. And you mentioned an instance in California that term limits were basically instituted to get at one politician, effectively affecting the career trajectories of everybody else. And to me, to write a law for one, two, three people in mind is kind of missing the point, especially if they come with negative consequences down the line. So if you have a problem with the length of terms or the length of service out to get past their mental capacities, perhaps a age restriction on their age when they're able to run for office or things like that is the most effective ways of approaching that problem without affecting literally everyone else in the meantime. But the reality is that the Senate is unrepresentative in so many ways, and age is one of them, where it's vastly older than the country at large, or at least the electorate. So that should be discussed, and we should talk about many reasons why that's true. And term limits won't solve almost any of them. So we should be specific about the problems we're trying to solve and then be specific about the solutions that will minimize the negative unintended consequences.
I'd also be remiss though if we don't acknowledge that there are entrenched advantages to incumbency that sort of fuel the term limit debate.
Mm-hmm. Yes, there are, but there's actually the incumbency advantage is less than at any time in the modern era, and there's more avenues for people through social media and elsewhere to get their name out there to dilute a lot of the institutional advantages that incumbents face. But the reality is that we don't have enough people participating. I mean, the vast majority of voters or non-voters actually can't say that who their member of Congress is. And when name recognition is the number one virtue, so just by seeing their name, you're more likely to click it if you know it. We need to have, I mean, too few people are invested in a system that can shake these things up. But at the same time, we see a lot of shocks each and every congressional cycle of like people that we think are untouchable go down. And that just shows we learn the lesson over and over that if you have a smart, disciplined ground game, if you really reach voters where they are, if you don't, you create a campaign that is focused on responding to the needs and wants of your constituents, you can shock the world. So, we need to take advantage of those opportunities.
You mentioned earlier, you described, term limits, as being a proposal that was a silver bullet. When I think of many of the issues that fuel term limits, I think of the current structure of money in politics, gerrymandered districts, senators and representatives that feel out of touch with constituents. Mm-hmm. These all feel intractable to me. And term limits, therefore, feels like a proximate response to an insoluble problem. And I wonder, is that how you see this whole conversation?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's funny you mentioned this, and I don't know how public this should be, but I'm literally writing a book proposal right now about a lot of the assumed problems with politics and how we're talking about them wrong and how we're falling consistently for these silver bullet solutions that A, won't work, B, treat all these problems in isolation, and in politics, nothing is ever in isolation, and C, will likely make a lot of these things work. It's not helpful, and the optimism that a solution like this, the optimism that it provides is actually unhelpful. It will kick the can down the road because term limits will not be put in place. So the longer that we ask for them, the more dependent we grow on them, the less we're spending time on things that we can actually affect. And it's just a self-reinforcing doom loop over and over, and it's frustrating.
Well, as for whether or not it should be public, I trust in the introduction that you will mention that I first raised this issue on the Public Morality in a public forum. So
I would be happy to, believe if I can get this stuff, if I can get this on paper, I can start sleeping at night, and a lot of good things will result from that.
All right, we're going to hold you to that. We'll have you back on for when the book's released. Well, how do you respond to those who say, well, you know, the president has term limits. You know, why should Congress be allowed to serve for life?
Yeah, there's no single issue, no single person in Congress that has the power of an individual presidency. I mean, he's a commander in chief. He has the nuclear code. So it makes sense because he has this outsized individual unilateral power. No member of Congress can come close to matching that. And so that's even an actual argument for saying to in this system of checks and balances, we shouldn't weaken the Congress against a president who has shown over and over and over that any power that's deferred to him, and he'll take, and he'll even try to take power that's not deferred to him, knowing that Congress won't have the gall to take it back. And so just because of the powers, the institutional powers, the political powers, and even the societal powers that we give to a president unilaterally, the power of his pen is infinitely more power than any pen resting in the hand of any individual member of Congress. So it makes sense to limit someone that holds that amount of unilateral power.
You know, just going back real quickly to the unfortunate findings of Senator Feinstein, mm-hmm. Some have argued that her staff is doing the work. I guess in a sort of paradoxical way, that sort of makes your point about being opposed to term limits is that staff becomes emboldened.
100%. I literally wrote a dissertation, and no one should ever read it, but I wrote a dissertation about the influence and role of congressional staffers, knowing how busy members of Congress are. So ignoring the fact that some of them may be incapacitated or at least not up to the day-to-day challenges of their job, they're doing so much and expected to do so much at once. They have to defer and rely on congressional staffers who are not elected. And so anytime that you defer your name to someone to decide on your behalf, you're giving them the power of the office. And so without them being accountable to voters. And so you do that if the less your members involved on policymaking issues, the more they rely on the advice of their staff, and staff are incredibly valuable resources. The more they rely on them, the more the accountability is less with the member and more with the staffer who doesn't face the voters. So the same thing can be true for lobbyists, the executive branch officials, and even congressional staff, where people are starting to make decisions who never have to face voters to as a plus or a thumbs up or thumbs down on their behaviors.
The preamble of the Constitution begins, "We the people," which is an implied assumption that sovereignty rests with the people. Mm-hmm. Does enacting term limits further chip away at that fundamental belief in the American experiment?
100%. If we should start, if we start with the premise that voters should have the choice to choose their elected officials, including throwing them out if enough of them don't think they're doing a good job, then we can't all of a sudden throw in this arbitrary deadline of except for when they've served X number of years, right? I mean, if you get to the point where it's 30, 40 years, then yes, we can have a conversation. But that's just such a few number that it's not worth throwing on the huge draconian measure to institute it for all of them. But if we're somehow limited in who we can choose for our elected officials outside of the few constitutional requirements that are in there, you know, a certain age, which in fact, we can even talk about how that ignores the reality that a lot of young people are more affected by policies than anyone else. Once we start throwing on these qualifications, we're going to end up at a point where voters lose power to choose their representatives. And that's kind of the whole point in the first place. If we don't have that, then one of the founding principles of what we're after is shook.
So is this conversation the result of decades of increasing exasperation by the voter, that we've become more cynical? We become more distrusting. And so in many ways, we feel powerless to really address the problems that have led some to conclude that we need to limit the terms of members of Congress.
Yes. Yes. A lot of this stems from a decades long message of like, these guys aren't doing the job, so let's get someone else. And not only are they not doing the job, they've made a position where it's their job to hold until they don't want it anymore. And so, A, we're not impacting policy, and B, we can't even, in the end, we're facing a rigged system where they're going to keep being reelected no matter what I want them to, whether I want them to be or not. And so after, and by the way, we should mention the role of politicians of exacerbating this message, right? One of the best messages to gain a position in Congress is to run against Congress, to tell you everything that's wrong with it, that we shouldn't trust those members, that they don't have your best interests at heart. I mean, that's literally how you win elections. And so I can't blame voters for hearing that message over and over, starting to believe it, because it's very hard to see a tangible impact when you're one of 750,000 in the House or a couple million choosing who the senator is. It's not likely that you have an opportunity to feel individually heard. So I get all that. But that's not the point. I mean, the system is built around that we are one of many, that all of our votes count the same. And we can talk about whether they do or not, but it's not because of term limits. The money in politics, the gerrymandering, the media, individual members of Congress. We all got to be honest about our role in this system and perpetuating what's wrong with Congress and not relying on these silver bullet answers that just simply aren't answers.
Well, in lieu of term limits, and should we remain with the status quo, which most, and I'm including you and I, would say is less than ideal, mm-hmm. What are the other long, arduous possibilities that you would put forth?
Yeah, this is when I say, okay, what problem are we trying to solve? Everything. So let's just go down the system, starting institutional. I think there's a conversation to talk about the filibuster. I think there's a conversation to talk about voting rights access, changing up the primary system, introducing potentially the idea of multi-member districts to get away from the two-party dynamic that we just think is ingrained in all democracies. It's not. Talking about the length of terms for members of Congress. There's not one developing democracy that has chosen a two-year term limit, a two-year cycle for their lower house. Money in politics, we can talk about limiting that type of way, and it's likely to go through the Supreme Court now, which, given its partisan composition, is unlikely to change that. Talking about the role of misinformation and disinformation. Then talking about how we as citizens are exacerbating a lot of these things. What type of conversations are we having? Are we sorting ourselves through our media choices and our literal living choices with only people that agree with us? And how is that clouding our judgment about what is right and what is wrong and our ability to hear differing perspectives? With members of Congress, them not putting things on the floor to have an open and honest debate about where people stand. Right now, the best way to keep a unified message is to keep votes off the floor that will show defection within the party. That ain't good for representation. We don't get to hear where people stand. We don't get to have that faction versus faction debate, which the House and Senate floor were designed to be. I mean, there's an endless list of all of these things, each with their own solutions, but it all starts on the fundamental principle within politics that nothing is in isolation and nothing comes without trade-offs. And so just to pretend that if we just do this one thing, if we just get rid of gerrymandering with nonpartisan commissions, if we just get rid of money in politics, then all of our political ills will be solved. They won't, because of all of this intractability, right? This, all of these things are interrelated, to say nothing of the fact that the system doesn't stop, right? There's no pause button. The next election is always coming. And so it's going to be really difficult to triage the problems that we need to in a way that will ultimately give us a better chance to be representative.
Finally, and this may be revealing some of my own cynicism, and based on my experience in California, that California also has an initiative process. And that process has become a cottage industry, if you will. I'm wondering, are we seeing a similar trend with the term limit debate, that beyond maybe having a constitutional amendment, which I doubt we would ever have, it doesn't seem likely right now, is just the notion of raising term limits itself become the self-perpetuating cottage industry that it just keeps us going, which actually works to keep the dysfunctional status quo operable?
Yeah, probably. I mean, we haven't seen it at the national level yet, but I am confident, given the money that is available in politics, it's an industry of it itself, where you can make a good living being on the consultant side, that when they see an opportunity to convince people that this is the right route, then people are going to start paying for their services, the same way lobbyists exist and campaign professionals too. So I wouldn't be surprised if that kind of makes its way to the more national stage, though. The petition side, the avenue for petition success is probably a lot different than in a lot of states across the country.
Professor Casey Burgert, George Washington University. Sir, I want to thank you for joining me today on the Public Morality. Much appreciated your insight, sir.
100%. And let me just say one final thing about term limits. If it's important to you, if it's important to your citizens and voters and even voter and members of Congress running for these jobs, they can term limit themselves, right? If that is important to their constituents, if they want to prove that this is something that they're in for, they can say, I won't run for re-election after X number of years. That's a good campaign message if people want to hear it. But you'll notice that the people that are the loudest advocates for these things, the ones in power, they're likely past their term limits for the ones that they want to enact on someone else. So let that be an indication of, okay, what are they gaining from advocating from this if they're not willing to adhere to it themselves? It's a good question to start from. But thanks for having me. I love talking about this stuff.
The Public Morality welcomes your comments. You can contact me at Byron@publicmorality.org. That's Byron, BYRON, @publicmorality.org. You can follow me on Facebook as well as Twitter. The archive broadcast can be found on iTunes, Spotify, Amazon Prime, and SoundCloud. Those listening to the Paul McReilly on WSNC can now listen on its app. Using your mobile device, simply go to your application page, search WSNC 90.5, and click open to listen from anywhere. And once again, I want to thank Elvin Jenkins and Michael Burns at WGAB in Huntsville, Alabama, for allowing us to broadcast the Paul McReilly at their studios. The Paul McReilly is produced at WSNC on the campus of Winston-Salem State University. For all of us at the Paul McReilly, I'm Byron Williams.